Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Gabe Eber, and I'll be moderating today's panel on hepatitis C behind bars. Begin with a question. What do you get when you combine an infectious disease, rapidly advancing therapeutics with high cure rates, but even higher price tags, and a nationwide prison population that's hovering around 2.2 million people? As you'll hear today from our speakers, you get a unique set of challenges, but you also get a unique set of opportunities. And we as the public health community, we get a chance, and I think as you'll hear today, a duty, really, to bring our collective skills and expertise to the table to tackle an epidemic. And there's a role for almost every public health discipline and sub-discipline, from clinical epidemiology to health promotion to public health law and ethics to health communication. Hepatitis C in incarcerated populations is one of the hottest topics, if not the hottest topic of 2014 in health and prisons, and I believe it will remain so for quite some time for reasons that you'll hear about in a few minutes. And so we're very fortunate today to have with us three experts who approach hepatitis C in prisons from three very different yet complementary perspectives. I'll introduce each speaker as we go and then ask that you save your questions until the end of all three talks. I'd like to introduce my friend and colleague, Rich Pfeffer, who is the Correctional Health Programs Manager at the Hepatitis Education Project, a Seattle-based nonprofit organization. He teaches viral hepatitis classes directly to offenders at 13 Washington State prison facilities. He's also the director of the National Hepatitis Corrections Network, a collaborative network of medical providers, administrators, researchers, community-based organizations, and other public health advocates working together to increase access to hepatitis prevention, testing, and treatment in correctional facilities. Rich has done an incredible job of bringing together experts from every discipline to an annual meeting and periodic calls to make sure that people are speaking with each other. Corrections people are speaking to community advocates, who are speaking to attorneys, who are speaking to clinicians, who are speaking to epidemiologists. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Rich.
Thanks, Gabe. All right. Thank you, Gabe. I really appreciate that. So I usually start by introducing myself, and I get to skip that today. I appreciate it. I work for a small nonprofit, as Gabe mentioned, and we're really just trying to bring these issues to light. So I'm going to give kind of a basic overview of some of the key points in epidemiology around hepatitis C in general, and then we're going to talk specifically more about corrections. So I do have a couple just disclosures. I have done sponsored presentations for Gilead and for Janssen before, and served on an ad board for Gilead, all around corrections issues in particular. The CDC has estimated that there are about 3.2 million people in the United States living with hepatitis C. That equates to about 1% of the U.S. population. Most people who are in this field actually all agree that the number is probably much higher. Does anybody know why? What? Go ahead. Sure. Yeah, the surveillance isn't comprehensive, and moreover, the actual study, the NHANES study that was used to calculate that number, 3.2 million, doesn't include many of the marginalized populations that are disproportionately affected by hepatitis C, including prisoners and including homeless people without an address. So there are many, many segments of the population that the NHANES study didn't cover who are actually more likely to be affected by hepatitis C. So other studies that have tried to sort of take a guess at what's been going on, the estimates hover around 5 million is probably a more realistic number, which makes it the most common blood-borne infection in the United States. There are about 17,000 new infections annually. The new infections right now are really concentrated among young people who inject drugs, which is also a group. This is a little bit of foreshadowing who we incarcerate. So we start to see the picture that takes place there. But other risk factors include any blood-to-blood contact. So blood transfusions before 1992, when we started screening the blood supply, hemophilia, unsafe tattoos, intranasal drug use, and male-male sex, or men who have sex with men, are at higher risk for hepatitis C. The number of new infections peaked in the 1980s, and it rose steadily through the 70s, and then it dropped significantly when we started screening the blood supply. So new infections peaked in the 1980s, and as a result of that, many of the people living with chronic hepatitis C are from the baby boomer generation, and so those are people born between 1945 and 1965. Those folks represent about 75% of people living with chronic hepatitis C, and the CDC recommends that any baby boomer, anybody born in that birth cohort, should get a one-time screening for hepatitis C, which is new just in the past couple of years. So they're really pushing to focus on that population as well. But the corrections population is a population where we have many opportunities to intervene here as well. Between 50 and 70% of those living with hepatitis C are unaware of that they're infected. So that has a huge impact on what we're able to do from a public health standpoint in terms of reducing the case burden of what is now a curable disease. Hepatitis C is the leading cause of liver transplants and a major cause of liver cancer. And the mortality around hepatitis C is rising. We talk about having this baby boomer population who have the highest rates of infection. Well, hepatitis C often takes 20 or 30 or 40 years to cause significant liver disease. And so that cohort is now aging and getting sicker. I know Dr. Strick's going to talk more about that after I'm finished. And as a result, we also have rising healthcare costs. And at this point in time, it's about $8 billion in healthcare costs. And I know that cost is a huge issue around hepatitis C. If anybody's been following the news around hepatitis C at all, the cost of these new medicines is a huge piece of that. And we know that the new medicines are really improving treatment. So treatment options are rapidly improving. It's been nothing short of revolutionary in the past 2 to 3 years. And it's treatments, first off, for those who don't know, hepatitis C is curable. It is now curable in a shorter amount of time for a larger percentage of people with much fewer side effects. And so I know Dr. Strick's going to elaborate on that, but it's a really interesting moment in time when it comes to hepatitis C because we have such effective therapies, and the issues are now becoming related to patient access and diagnosis and case finding and those types of things. So this is where we're at, or at least one of the best estimates of where we're at. This is called the hepatitis C cascade of care, this is based on that CDC estimate of about 3.2 million. So for every 100 people who are living with chronic hepatitis C, only about 50 have been diagnosed. Of those 50 who have been diagnosed, only about 35 have been referred to care. Only 9% have actually been treated for hepatitis C, and 6% have actually achieved a sustained virologic response, which is what we consider a cure. And so only 6 out of 100 people living with chronic hepatitis C at this point in time are cured. And so that's pretty abysmal, right? And now what we have is this epidemic concentrated largely in our correctional institutions. Because we incarcerate people from marginalized communities that often have disproportionate risk for hepatitis C, we see a large percentage of the case burden for hepatitis C in corrections. About 30% of the Hep C case burden is in corrections. That's according to a 2013 study. And I've actually seen it quoted in several other studies in the past as well. And as Gabe mentioned during his introduction, we incarcerate more than 2.2 million people in the United States. And 1 in 3 Americans have been incarcerated or spent a night in a prison or a jail at some point. People in prison or jail often have a higher likelihood of past risk behavior for hepatitis C, and some of these bullets focus on drug use history, although that's not the only risk factor as we know. But around 16% of total state, around 16% of state prison population in 2012 were related to drug offenses. But drug offenders are not the only folks at risk for. So 24% of state prison inmates had a history of injection drug use in a 2002 study. We were talking over dinner the other night and would guess that number is likely higher these days, especially given the rise in heroin in the past few years and the increase in the number of young people who are injecting. And around 17 or 18% of federal prisons committed their crime to obtain money for drugs. So we know that the drug war that drives the high incarceration rates that we have going on disproportionately affects people with risk factors for hepatitis C. And other risks, such as unprotected sex, or unsafe tattoos are often concentrated in prisons as well, and we can't really emphasize the tattoos enough as well when we do prevention education directly with offenders, because tattoos are a huge issue in prisons and jails. We also know that risk behaviors persist in prisons or jails despite zero tolerance policies around tattooing or around injection drug use in prisons. And we do know, though we don't have a good idea of how much, but we do know that disease transmission occurs in prisons. That's actually a large area that should that needs to be looked at, is how much disease transmission occurs behind bars. But as a result of all these factors that impact people who are in prison, there are highly disproportionate rates of hepatitis C in prisons and jails compared to the general population. So if 1 to 2% of the general population has hepatitis C, it's actually about 17.5% in corrections. So that's a huge number. And that 17.4% number is actually a recent estimate, and the CDC gave a range of between 12 and 35%. And the reason why that window is so large is, like this person over here mentioned earlier, that the surveillance is not very good. So we've got a really long way to go, even to figure out where we're at. And I think that that's a really interesting thing. But what we do know is that this epidemic is largely concentrated in prisons and jails. And so we have, for better or for worse, a captive population who we can... and that presents opportunities along with challenges. Let's see where we're at here. So I think that Laura and Ben are going to talk a lot about opportunities, and I definitely think that when we have such a disproportionate number of people living in one place, oftentimes this is the first chance for us to intervene with these groups of people. Oftentimes these marginalized populations are not necessarily engaged in healthcare when they're not incarcerated, and so working with people who are incarcerated is a large opportunity, but we do know that there are lots of different challenges, and we do know that there in corrections it's much more complicated. So we know we have a long way to go in the community, but in corrections we have an even more fragmented system. There's no national surveillance system for prisons or jails around infectious disease. There's no sort of organization that oversees that. We also have a really fragmented correctional system in our country. We don't have one system called corrections, right? We have prisons and jails, which are different, and I'll talk about the difference for those who aren't aware in a minute. We've also got federal and state jurisdictions that run different facilities. We've also got private and public prisons. We've also got private and public healthcare providers in prisons. And so we don't have a uniform system, and there are many, many different challenges depending on what jurisdiction you operate and what type of facility you operate and what kind of state you operate. Another challenge is that the priority for corrections is not public health. These are not institutions that are set up for public health. These are institutions that are set up to provide security, and that is their priority. And so trying to talk with corrections can be a challenge in terms of that their number one goal isn't necessarily to make our communities healthier. Their main goal is security and in the past often punishment, right? So the priorities for corrections is often not public health. Another thing is that Hep C treatment is very expensive, and it's changing very rapidly. And so correctional systems are at stretched thin when it comes to budgets. That's been true forever. And they don't respond well to rapid changes, usually. And so it's a difficult system when things are changing quickly. One of the things that's really, really interesting is we talk a lot about opportunities around hepatitis C treatment, and I think many of the opportunities, when we talk about a diagnosis rate of around 50% nationwide, one of the best opportunities that we have in corrections is to provide testing and screening. And so there are many different models in which we can do that, which I'll talk about in a second. But one of the challenges that we find is with the expensive treatment and the challenges that are presented in a correctional setting for providing hepatitis C treatment is that if a facility is not able to provide treatment, that's a disincentive to provide testing. So there could be pressure on a facility to treat, but also they're spending some money on something that doesn't necessarily have any consequence for the facility. And so there's often a disincentive to test if a facility is unable to offer treatment. As a result of a lot of these challenges, only 12 state prison systems routinely tested for hepatitis C between 2001 and 2012. And what that means is routine, systematic. It doesn't necessarily mean they screened everybody. There are lots of different ways that facilities around the country, and it's based, it's largely different just depending on what state and what county you're in. But their screening practices vary widely. There are some institutions that don't test. There are some institutions that test only if somebody's symptomatic, which if anybody knows about hepatitis C, most people don't present symptoms, and so it's a pretty bad way to go about testing. Some people test by request only. Probably the two most common ways that facilities are testing, prisons and jails, is either, and probably the most common way is risk-based. So if somebody presents risk factors at an intake, so if they're a baby boomer, some systems have experimented with screening the baby boomer cohort. But typically it's they will screen with an IDU history, injection drug use history, or if they see new tattoos, or if they come down with jaundice or other symptoms. Part of the problem is that for folks who have ongoing risk, admitting to those behaviors in a correctional setting gets you in trouble. And so for folks that may continue some of those behaviors behind bars, they're often not able to admit that risk and therefore be referred to testing. The model that's been used in Washington State, where I live sometimes, where Dr. Strick practices, is universal opt-out testing, where everybody is screened on entry to the facility, actually entry to the system, unless they refuse. And that has been, I think there's about five or six states that have been using opt-out testing. And do you know the exact number, Laura? I don't know. I think it's about five.
Few.
It's very few. So if we're talking about 50 state prison systems, it's 10% or less. And that's even new for several of those systems in just the past couple of years. So most systems that are providing testing are providing risk-based testing, although universal opt-out testing has been shown to find more cases over time and be a much more effective means at actually at case finding. There are different models that test either on entry or on release. And some systems that test on entry, like Washington State, that's that universal opt-out screening. But one interesting model is testing on release. And this does actually work for some systems who can't provide treatment, but who can provide referrals to care in the community. And it is an opportunity for folks to get screened, even if they can't get treated while they're incarcerated. And so there are models of that more often in jail than in prison settings. But that is one way and something to consider. And there's also access to confirmatory testing. So hepatitis C antibody screening only tests for exposure to hepatitis C. And around 20% of people who are exposed to hepatitis C actually naturally fight that virus off. So there's a more complex blood test that needs to be done in order to actually confirm a diagnosis. And in a prison setting, individuals who screen for who screen antibody positive may or may not have access to confirmatory testing while they're incarcerated or after they're released. So we have a lot of challenges and a lot of room for improvement in this area in terms of screening. And I know Dr. Strick's going to talk more about treatment. So these are some of the issues kind of that we talk about nationwide and that make it difficult for us as public health advocates to track what's going on and for us to work together to really find common solutions because we have such a fragmented system and we've got such a long way to go. Thank you. Well, that's perfect time. All right. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about as well is that the opportunities vary whether someone is in prison or in jail. And the reason is because prisons and jails are structured very differently. Prisons are, jail is where someone goes before they're adjudicated, before they're convicted, and before they're sentenced, most of the time. And so typically they have a short length of stay. The average is either days or weeks. Treatment in that scenario is less feasible. There's limited medical infrastructure in a jail. There are usually much shorter sentences, so oftentimes there's not time to do the workup and actually complete the treatment. And there are smaller budgets. However, with shorter durations of treatment with hepatitis C, it may start to become more feasible to treat in a jail setting. Testing varies in jail settings, but it does happen. There are many jails that provide some testing, but the key to testing in jail is to have really strong linkage to care services because people are going to be moving in and out that revolving door and they need to be referred to community providers. Otherwise, that test, if you lose someone to follow up right after that test, you haven't done too much, right? And it's also a huge opportunity for education and prevention, providing classes, talking to people about prevention so that when they go back out into the community, they can reduce their own risk and reduce the risk of others. A prison setting, on the other hand, is designed for much longer lengths of stay. The average prison sentence is around 2 or 3 years. And so prisons are set up, and they usually have a bit more developed healthcare infrastructure. They have larger budgets, and so there is a more developed structure oftentimes for being able to provide either screening or treatment. But what we see nationwide is that screening is limited, and it is variable, as is treatment. Although treatment is more feasible in a prison setting than it is in a jail setting. But many prisons don't treat, and treatment, when available, is limited, and it's actually limited in many of the same ways that treatment is being prioritized in the community right now, which is for people with higher fibrosis scores and who are at greater risk for advancing really quickly. Prisons and jails, depending on what setting you work in or what setting you want to collaborate with, there are many different considerations that need to take place, and the challenges are different. So there are a lot of unanswered questions, and this is a really short overview. This has been, like Gabe said, this has been one of the hottest topics in correctional health for a little while now, and I know that Dr. Strick's going to talk about the advances in therapy. But there are many unanswered questions that we have to think about as public health advocates. One of the most important is, what is the role of corrections in public health? And in my view, correctional health is public health. 95% of prisoners will be released back into our communities. When those prisoners are released back into our communities healthier, our communities are healthier. A good question, especially with the high cost of Hep C meds that we're going to talk about today, is treating hepatitis C in corrections cost effective? And if it's cost effective, is it feasible? How do we solve challenges together involving all stakeholders, community and correctional stakeholders? Because this epidemic affects many different stakeholders. Corrections is a huge stakeholder, but oftentimes when we ask corrections to do something, we need to make sure that they can't do it alone, that they shouldn't do it alone. It's just one pillar of what should be a much more rounded public health strategy to eradicate hepatitis C. And also, how can we increase the capacity of correctional healthcare service providers for hepatitis C? And how can we improve care coordination between institutions and the community? And in states where we've expanded Medicaid, how can we leverage the Affordable Care Act to do so? So I pose a number of questions that I think these subsequent speakers will help answer, and that I hope that you can keep in mind as we continue to talk about this topic. It's a very general overview. There are lots of specific issues we can talk about: linkage to care, treatment, testing, screening, education, all kinds of different things, and we'll touch on a lot of those today. So with that, I'll kind of pass it to Dr. Strick, and I will go from there. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.